parents dropped him off one night. She'd heard of children like this, who had been given away. After her father died, her mother's sister offered to take one of the twins.
It's too much,
Aunt Sophie had said, clasping their mother's hands.
Let us lighten your load.
The twins pressed against their bedroom door, listening hard, each wondering if she would be the one to go. Would Aunt Sophie take her pick, like choosing a puppy out of a basket, or would their mother decide which daughter she could live without? Eventually, their mother told Aunt Sophie that she could not separate her girls, but later, Desiree learned that her aunt had asked for her. Aunt Sophie lived in Houston, and Desiree used to imagine her life there, a city girl, whisking around in starched dresses and shiny leather shoes, not the faded calico her mother salvaged from the church bin. After Mallard, Early said, he was sick of farming other people's land. So he set off to Baton Rouge to try his luck. Well, the only luck he found was the hard kind. He spent a year there, stealing car parts in order to feed himself, until he got caught and shipped off to Angola State Prison. He was 20 then, already a man in the eyes of the law, and truth-telling, he'd felt like a man since the night his parents left him without saying goodbye. The world worked differently than he'd ever imagined. People you loved could leave, and there was nothing you could do about it. Once he'd grasped that, the inevitability of leaving, he became a little older in his own eyes. He spent 4 years in prison, a time he leapt over and would never in all his life talk much about.
Does that change anything? He asked her.
She imagined him in a phone booth somewhere, his boot kicked up on the glass.
What would it change? She said.
He was quiet a minute, then said,
Oh, I don't know.
But she knew what he meant. Would she think about him differently now? She wasn't sure what she thought about him at all. She'd had a crush on him once, long ago, but she didn't know the man he'd grown up to be. She had no idea what he wanted from her. Weeks before, he'd offered to find Stella. And when she told him that she couldn't pay him right away, he said,
That's all right.
What you mean, that's all right? She said.
I mean, I don't need it right off. You can work something out.
She'd never met a working man who was so casual about his money. But then again, she'd never met a working man who did what Early did for a living. He hunted bail jumps who'd disappeared without a trace, hoping to start over somewhere new. But there was always a trail if you looked closely enough. No one disappeared completely. Again, she thought about the envelope of photographs he'd given her. In the diner, she'd held the package, her heart thudding.
Don't worry, he'd said. I seen that son of a bitch far away from here.
She must have looked unsure, because he said,
Trust me, I won't give you up.
But why wouldn't he? He barely knew her, and Sam had offered him good money. What reason did he have to be loyal to her? For weeks, she'd wondered if she and Jude should move on again. If Sam was looking, wouldn't he eventually find her? Wouldn't he just travel to Mallard himself? But maybe now, Mallard was the safest place to be. Sam's hired man told him she wasn't in Louisiana, and what reason would Sam have to doubt him? Maybe she could trust Early. If he'd wanted to hurt her, Sam would have found her already. But just because she could trust him didn't mean that he didn't want anything.
He just telling you what you wanna hear,
her mother said one night, handing her a wet plate.
That man don't know where Stella is any more than you do.
Desiree sighed, reaching for the dish rag. But he knows how to look, she said.
Why shouldn't we try?
She don't want to be found. You gotta let her go. Live a life.
This ain't her life, Desiree said.
None of it would have happened if I didn't tell her to take that job or drag her to New Orleans, period. That city wasn't no good for Stella. You was right all along.
Her mother pursed her lips.
It wasn't her first time, she said.
Ma'am?
Being white,
her mother said.
Nollins was just her chance to do it for real.
Here was the story her mother had been keeping. A week after Stella disappeared into the city, Willie Lee came by the shotgun house, Hangdog. He had something to tell Adele, something he should have told her weeks before Founder's Day. One afternoon, he'd driven Stella into Opelousas. She helped him around the butcher shop on weekends because she was quick at adding figures in her head. She could eyeball a pound of ground chuck more accurately than him, and whenever he weighed her measurements, she was never off. She was a smart, careful girl. But that last summer, he'd noticed something different about her. She seemed sadder, wrapped up in herself. Because she'd dropped out of school, he figured, although he didn't quite understand it, having flunked out of ninth grade himself. A girl who could eyeball a pound of ground chuck would do fine in life, college or not. But not everybody was practical-minded like him. So when Stella suddenly stood behind the cash register, he figured that she was still disappointed that she wouldn't be off to Spelman someday, like she'd hoped. So he'd invited her to Opelousas one afternoon. He had to make deliveries and figured, hell, she might want to get out of town for a bit. He'd given her a nickel to buy a Coke, and when he'd finished unloading, he found her standing beside his truck, breathless and flushed. She'd gone inside some shop called Darlene's Charms, where the shop girl mistook her for white.
"Isn't it funny?" she'd said. "White folks so easy to fool, just like everyone says."
"It ain't no game," he told her. "Passing over, it's dangerous."
"But white folks can't tell," she said. "Look at you. You just as red-headed as Father Kavanaugh. Why does he get to be white and you don't?"
"Because he is white," he said. "And I don't want to be."
"Well, neither do I," she'd said. "I just wanted to look at that shop. You won't tell my mama, will you?"
And Mallard, you grew up hearing stories about folks who'd pretended to be white. Warren Fontenot, riding a train in the white section, and when a suspicious porter questioned him, speaking enough French to convince him that he was a swarthy European. Marlena Goudeau, becoming white to earn her teaching certificate. Luther Thibodeau, whose foreman marked him white and gave him more pay. Passing like this from moment to moment was funny, heroic even. Who didn't want to get over on white folks for a change? But the Passe Blanc were a mystery. You could never meet one who'd passed over undetected, the same way you'd never know someone who successfully faked her own death. The act could only be successful if no one ever discovered it was a ruse. Desiree only knew the failures, the ones who'd gotten homesick or caught or tired of pretending. But for all Desiree knew, Stella had lived white for half her life now. And maybe acting for that long ceased to be acting altogether. Maybe pretending to be white eventually made it so.
"Finishing up,"
Early said, two nights later, calling outside of Shreveport.
"Heading back your way if you still want to look for your sister."
She had never imagined that Stella kept big secrets from her. Not Stella, who'd slept beside her, whose thoughts ran like a current between them, whose voice she heard in her own head. How could she have spent that whole summer not knowing that Stella had already decided to become someone else? She didn't know who Stella was anymore. And maybe she'd never quite known her at all. She twirled her finger tighter around the phone cord. Inside the empty diner, Jude sat at the counter reading a book. She was always reading, always alone.
"Yes,"
Desiree said.
"I suppose so."
The morning Early Jones arrived, the sky hung heavy and hot with rain. From the edge of the couch, Desiree listened to the spring storm as she braided Jude's hair,
remembering those first weeks in New Orleans, ducking with Stella under eaves when the showers caught them unaware. She eventually grew used to the capricious rain, but back then she'd shriek at every sudden storm, laughing with Stella as they pressed against the side of a building, water splattering against their ankles. On the rug in front of her, Jude squirmed, pointing at the porch.
"Mama, a man," she said.
And there was Early, standing on the front steps, jacket collar flipped up, his beard flecked with raindrops. Desiree scrambled to her feet, feeling strangely nervous, and she didn't realize until she opened the door that they were standing exactly where they'd first met a lifetime ago.
"You can come in," she said.
"You sure?"
he said.
"Don't want to make no mess."
He looked as nervous as she felt, which emboldened her. She beckoned him inside, and he kicked his boots against the porch, shucking off mud. Then he followed her, standing in the doorway, one hand balled up in his jacket pocket.
"This is Jude," she said. "Jude, come say hi to Mr. Early. I'm going on a little drive with him, remember?"
"It's just Early,"
he said.
"I ain't nobody's mister."
He smiled, holding out his hand. Jude slid hers into his for a second, then darted off into the bedroom to fetch her book bag. Later, on the interstate, Early asked if Jude was always so quiet. Desiree gazed out the window, watching the sunlight glint off Lake Pontchartrain.
"Always," she said. "She ain't like me at all." "Like her daddy, then."
She didn't like talking about Sam to Early. Didn't even want to imagine both men existing within the same expanse of her life. Besides, Jude wasn't like Sam either. She was, in a way, like Stella. Private. Like if she told you anything about herself, she was giving away something she could never get back.
"No," she said. "Not like anybody but herself."
"That's good. For a girl to be herself."
"Not in Mallard," she said. "Not a girl like Jude." Early touched her hand, surprising her. Then remembering himself, he pulled away.
"Won't be easy,"
he said.
"Wasn't easy for me. You know, a man smacked me once at church. Right on the back of my neck. All because I put my finger in the holy water before his wife. Like I ruined it somehow. I thought my uncle was gonna stick up for me. I don't know why, I just thought. But he told a man sorry like I done something wrong."
He let out a bitter laugh. On the other side of the interstate, a freight train rumbled along, rainwater sloughing off the tracks. She turned back to him, eyes also wet.
"I should have said something," she said. "Did my mama run you off like that?"
He shrugged.
"Long time ago."
"So why are you helping me then? Why really?"
"Oh, I don't know,"
he said.
"Guess it made me sad, thinking about you and your sister."
He stared ahead, refusing to look at her.
"And I guess I just like talking with you. Ain't talked to no woman so much in all my life."
She laughed.
"You ain't said but two words at a time."
"It's enough,"
he said. She laughed again, touching the back of his neck. And later, he would tell her that was the first time he knew. That gentle hand on the back of his neck as he steered the car across the bridge. They were chasing the past, searching for Stella down streets and stairwells and alleyways. Trampling up the steps of the twins' three-story walk-up, where an elderly colored couple now lived. Desiree asked, as politely as she could, if they might have received any mail intended for a Desiree or a Stella Veens, but they'd only lived there for 2 years. The lives of the twin girls had already faded into the apartment walls long before they'd arrived. Sisters cooking together, listening to the little transistor radio that had been their first luxury purchase. Sisters staying up until dawn, feeling finally like the grown women they believed themselves to be. Sisters signing the lease to that first apartment, although maybe even then, Stella had known that the arrangement would be temporary. Maybe she had already started searching for a way out. All afternoon, they hunted Stella in the old spots. They asked after her in Dixie Laundry and the Grace Note. Desiree searched for old friends in the phone book, but nobody had heard from Stella. Farrah Thibodeau, married now to an alderman, laughed when Desiree called.
"I can't believe little Stella's run off," she said. "Now you, I would have thought."
"Thanks anyway," Desiree said, starting to hang up.
"Wait a minute," Farrah said. "I don't know what your hurry is. I was going to tell you I saw your sister."
Her heart quickened. "When?"
"Oh, a long time ago, before you left. She was walking down Royal Street just as carefree as she could be. Arm in arm with a white man, too. Looked right at me, then looked the other way. I swear she saw me."
"You sure it was her?"
"As sure that it wasn't you," Farrah said. "It's all in her eyes, honey. Her white man was handsome, too. Must have been why she was smiling like that."
Stella leaving her to chase after some man. Stella secretly in love. Stella, who had never been boy crazy, who had rolled her eyes at Desiree mooning over early, who had never even had a boyfriend before. The frigid twin, the boys called her. But Early told her that the simplest explanation is often the right one.
"You'd be surprised by what emotion make people do," he said.
"But I know her," she said, then stopped herself. She couldn't assume anything about Stella anymore. Hadn't she learned that already? She was exhausted by the time Early suggested she try the Maison Blanche building. She'd only ventured inside once before, days after Stella first disappeared. She'd told herself, riding the streetcar down Canal, that Stella couldn't be gone for good. This was Stella, fallen into one of her bad moods. Stella playing hide and seek, ducking behind the drying sheets. She told herself lots of reassuring things she didn't believe. Stella would pop back up. She would appear on their apartment stoop and explain herself. She wouldn't walk away from the best job she'd ever had. She wouldn't leave her sister behind. Inside the department store, Desiree had wandered, walking slowly down the perfume aisle. She knew that Stella worked in an office on one of the top floors, but she didn't know which one. In the lobby, she studied the directory so long, the brusque security guard asked what her business was. She'd faltered, afraid to expose Stella, and he finally shooed her away.
"Too pushy," Early said. "You gotta have a soft touch. You come across too desperate. Folks sense it. Clam up."
They were sitting in a cafe across the street from Maison Blanche. She'd barely touched her espresso. She was still thinking about the white man Farrah saw Stella with, how happy she'd looked. She didn't want to be found. What was Desiree doing, trying to drag her back into a life she no longer wanted?
"You gotta go in there like somebody they tell things to," he said. "Somebody that gets what she wants."
"Be white, you mean?"
He nodded.
"Easier that way," he said. "I can't go in with you, give you away. But you just go in, say you're looking for somebody, an old friend, not your sister, that raised too many questions. Tell them you lost touch, something like that. Just keep it light, breezy, like a white lady with no worry on her mind."
So she imagined herself as Stella. Not the Stella she once knew, but Stella as she was now, pushing past the giant brass MB door handles, stepping inside the department store. She passed through the perfume aisle with the confidence of a woman who could buy any bottle she wished, She stopped to smell a few, as if she were considering a purchase, admired the jewelry in the display case, glanced at the fine handbags, demurred when salesgirls approached her. In the lobby, the colored elevator operator gazed at the floor when she stepped on. She ignored him, the way Stella might have. She felt queasy at how simple it was. All there was to being white was acting like you were. When she entered the first office level, a white security guard hurried over to help her. She played back Early's words, light, breezy, no worry on her mind. She told him that she was looking for an old friend who used to work in marketing. Of course, he couldn't find Estella Veens in the building directory, but he gave her directions to the department. She rode the elevator to the 6th floor, and when she stepped inside the office, she braced herself for someone to mistake her for Stella. But the red-headed secretary just smiled at her pleasantly. "I'm looking for an old friend," Desiree said. "She used to be a secretary here."
"And what's the name?"
"Stella Veens." She glanced around the quiet office, as if by speaking her name she might have conjured her.
"Stella Veens,"
the secretary repeated, turning to a file cabinet behind her. She hummed to herself as she searched, the only other sounds, the gentle clacking of typewriters. Desiree tried to imagine Stella in a place like this, joining the ranks of other polite white girls sitting at their desks. The secretary returned to her seat, holding a file folder.
"No current address, I'm afraid," she said. "Our last few Christmas cards returned to sender."
She was so apologetic, so sorry that she could only give Desiree the most recent address she had on file, a card filled out in Stella's careful handwriting, with the forwarding address leading her to Boston, Massachusetts.
"And no smoking gun," Early said that night. "But it's a start."
They were sitting together in a darkened booth at the Surly Goat, Early sipping his whiskey slowly. In the morning, he'd be gone again, a new job carrying him off to Durham. But after that, he would go to that address in Boston, see what he could dig up there. She couldn't imagine how Stella found herself in that city of all places. But it didn't matter. That scrap of paper held more new information about Stella than Desiree had ever learned. She felt, again, overwhelmed by Early's help, unsure of how she could ever manage to thank him. After they finished their drinks, she walked him to the boarding house. He tucked her hand under his arm as they climbed up the muddy steps, and she didn't pull away, not even once they were inside his room. She wasn't drunk, but the room suddenly felt hot. She hadn't undressed in front of a strange man in years. Slowly, then, he was leaning against the worn dresser, waiting, and she pressed against him, trailing her hand down his stomach. He stopped her at his belt.
"It's just a start," he said. "I ain't no closer to finding her."
He held on to her hand, as if he understood that this was a condition for them to go any further. "All right," she said.
"I might not. She might just be gone. You know that, right?"
She paused.
"I know. I'll look as long as you want me to," he said. "Tell me to stop, and I'll stop."
She rested her hand free, slipping it under his black t-shirt. Her fingers brushed against a rough scar stretching across his stomach. He shivered. "Don't stop," she said. Part 2. Maps. 1978. Chapter 4. In the autumn of 1978, a dark girl blew into Los Angeles from a town that existed on no maps. She rode a greyhound all the way from this unmapped place, her two suitcases rattling in the undercarriage. a girl from nowhere and nothing, and if you'd asked any of the other passengers, they would have noticed nothing interesting about her except that she was so, well, black. Aside from that, quiet. Flipping through a worn detective novel that her mother's boyfriend had given her for her 17th birthday, which she was reading for the second time to find all the clues she'd missed. At rest stops, she clamped that book under her arm, walking in slow circles to stretch her legs, twitchy. She reminded the Italian bus driver of a cheetah pacing around a cage. He wouldn't have been surprised at all to learn that she was a runner. That lean, boyish body, those long legs. He smoked his cigarette, watching her make another lap around the bus. Too bad. Those legs with that face, that skin. Jesus, he'd never seen a woman that black before. She didn't notice the bus driver watching her. She barely noticed anyone staring at her at all anymore. Or if she did, she knew exactly why they were looking. She was impossible to miss. Dark, yes, but also tall and rangy, just like her father, whom she had not seen or heard from in 10 years. She took another slow lap, trying to find her place in that dog-eared book with the cracked spine. She'd loved detective stories ever since she was little. She used to sit on the porch while her mother's boyfriend cleaned his gun and told her about the men he hunted. Later, it had seemed like a strange bonding activity for a grown man and a little girl, but she'd already learned that Early Jones was a strange man. Not her father, but the closest to it she would ever come. She liked watching him slowly disassemble the gun while she peppered him with questions. You could find just about anybody if you were good at lying, he told her. Half of hunting was pretending to be somebody else, an old friend searching for his buddy's address, a long-lost nephew trying to find his uncle's new phone number, a father inquiring about the whereabouts of his son. There was always someone close to the mark that you could manipulate, always a window in if you couldn't find a door. Ain't that exciting? He told her, chewing on a toothpick. Most of it just sweet-talking old ladies on the phone. He made finding the lost sound so easy that once she'd asked if he could search for her daddy. He didn't look up at her, swabbing his brush inside the gun barrel. You don't want me to go looking for him, he said.
Why not?
Because, he said, he's not a nice man.
He was right, of course. But she hated how certain he was. How could he possibly know? He'd never even met her daddy. She'd always imagined her father driving up in his shiny Buick to rescue her. She'd step out of school one day and find him waiting, her father, tall and handsome, smiling at her, arms open. The other kids would gawk. Then he'd bring her back to D.C., and she'd go to school and make friends and date boys and run track and go off to college in a place so unlike Mallard that she would hardly believe that Mallard even existed, that she hadn't just imagined it. But 10 years passed, no phone calls or letters. In the end, she rescued herself. She won a gold medal in the 400 meters at the state championship meet, and miracle of miracles, college recruiters saw her. She'd run as hard as she could, and now she was getting the hell out. At the bus station, she'd stood at the base of the metal steps while Early loaded her suitcases. Her grandmother slipped her rosary over her neck before her mother pulled her into a hug.
I still don't know why you want to go all the way out to California, she said. There's some perfectly good schools right here.
She laughed a little. As if she were kidding, as if she hadn't been trying to convince Jude to stay. They both knew that she couldn't. She'd already accepted the track scholarship from UCLA, as if she could even think about turning it down. And now she was standing in front of a bus, waiting to climb on.
I'll call, she said, and write.
You better.
It'll be fine, Mama. I'll come back and see you.
but they both knew that she'd never come back to Mallard. On the bus, she fiddled with the rosary beads, imagining her mother traveling away from Mallard on a bus like this. Except she hadn't been alone, Stella beside her staring out into the dark. Jude held the worn paperback in her lap, pressing against the filmy window. She'd never seen a desert before. It seemed to stretch on forever. Another mile ticked by, carrying her further from her life. They called her Tar Baby. Midnight, Darky, Mud Pie, said, "Smile, we can't see you." Said, "You so dark you blend into the chalkboard." Said, "Bet you could show up naked to a funeral. Bet lightning bugs follow you in the daytime. Bet when you swim, it look like oil." They made up lots of jokes, and once, well into her 40s, she would recite a litany of them at a dinner party in San Francisco. "Bet cockroaches call you cousin. Bet you can't find your own shadow." She was amazed by how well she remembered. At that party, she forced herself to laugh, even though she'd found nothing funny at the time. The jokes were true. She was black. Blue black. No, so black she looked purple. Black as coffee, asphalt, outer space, black as the beginning and the end of the world. At first, her grandmother tried to keep her out of the sun, gave her a big gardening hat, tied the straps tight around her chin even though it choked her. She couldn't run with the hat on, and she loved to run, which couldn't be helped, although Adele begged her to wait, at least until the sun went down. She'd spent her summers reading indoors, or when she felt like she was going crazy from being cooped up, she chased shade around the yard, wearing the big choking hat, long sleeves clinging to her sweaty arms. She would get no darker, although she seemed to the longer she lived in Mallard, a black dot in the school pictures, a dark speck on the pews at Sunday Mass, a shadow lingering on the riverbank while the other children swam, so black that you could see nothing but her, a fly in milk, contaminating everything. In homeroom, she sat in front of Lonnie Godot, the varsity pitcher who threw paper balls at her back all period. He was gray-eyed with auburn hair, licking up the back of his neck, his cheeks splashed with freckles. A beautiful boy. So she prickled when she imagined him staring at her, rolling up his sleeves, his forearms so light you could see the brown hair, and flexing, the paper pinched between his fingers. Then she felt the soft pat against her neck. The boys behind her snickering. She never turned around. Once, Mr. Yancey caught Lonnie and sentenced him to detention. On her way out, Jude passed him wiping down the chalkboard, and he smirked at her, sliding the eraser through the dust. She replayed that moment her whole walk home, his lips caught between a grimace and a smile. Lonnie Godot was the first person to call her Tar Baby. A month after she moved to Mallard, he found a copy of Br'er Rabbit in the class bin and gleefully tapped the shiny black blob on the cover. "Look, it's Jude," he said. And she was so startled that he knew her name. She didn't realize that he was making fun of her until the whole class dissolved into laughter. He was chastened for disrupting silent reading, the book quickly removed by their blushing teacher. But that night after dinner, Jude asked her mother what a tar baby was. Her mother paused, dipping their dirty plates into the sink. "Just an old story," she said. "Why?" "A boy called me that today." Her mother slowly dried her hands on the towel, then knelt in front of her. "He just wants to get a rise out of you," she said. "Ignore him. He'll get bored and cut all that out." But he didn't. Lonnie flecked mud at her socks and threw her books into the trash, jostled her chair leg during exams, yanked the ribbons in her hair, sang Tutti Frutti Dark Judy as soon as she was in earshot, On the last day of fifth grade, he tripped her down the school steps, and she scraped her knee. At the kitchen table, her grandma pulled her leg onto her lap, gently swabbing the blood with a cotton ball.
"Maybe he likes you," Mama said. "Little boys always act real mean to girls they like."
She tried to imagine Lonnie holding her hand, carrying her books home from school, kissing her even, his long eyelashes tickling her cheeks, sitting beside him in a movie theater or on the top of the Ferris wheel at the carnival, Lonnie's arm around her. But all she could picture was Lonnie splashing her in a mud puddle or sticking chewing gum in her hair or calling her a dumb bitch, Lonnie punching her until her lip burst open and her eyes swelled shut. After, her father would always storm out while her mother sobbed on the floor, her face buried in the couch cushion. Once, he didn't leave right away. Instead, he pulled her mother's face into his stomach, petting her hair. Her mother whimpered but didn't pull away, as if she were comforted by his touch. Better to picture Lonnie beating on her. That other thing, that soft part, terrified her even more. Before the insults and jokes, before the taunting, the muddied socks, the kicked chairs, the empty lunch bench, before all of that, there were questions. What was her name? Where'd she come from and why was she here? On her first day of school, Louisa Rubidoux leaned across their shared desk and asked who was that lady walking with her earlier.
"My mama,"
Jude said. Wasn't it obvious? She'd walked her to school, held her hand. Who else would she be?
"But not your real mama, right?"
Louisa said.
"Y'all don't look nothing alike."
Jude paused, then said,
"I look like my daddy." "Well, where's he at?"
She shrugged, even though she knew. Back in D.C., where they'd left him. She missed him already, even though she could still see that bruise on her mother's neck, even though she could remember all the bruises she'd seen on her body over time, dark splotches on that strange topography. Once, at the swimming pool, she'd stared as her mother started to change in their stall before stopping midway when she discovered a fading bruise on her thigh. She quietly put her clothes back on, then told Jude she'd decided to just sit by the pool today and watch her. When they arrived home, her father greeted her mother with a kiss, and Jude realized that if she tried, she could pretend that the bruises came from someplace else. Her relationship with one parent magically untethered to the other. So when she thought of her daddy, he was sprawled beside her on the rug, flipping through the comics, not dragging her mother by her hair into the bedroom. No, that was some other man. And after the broken glass was swept, the blood wiped off the tile, after her mother retreated into the bathroom, a bag of ice pressed against her face, her real daddy returned, smiling, stroking her cheek.
"How come I don't look like you?"
she asked her mother that night. She was sitting on the worn rug in front of the couch while her mother braided her hair so she couldn't see her face, but felt her hands still.
"I don't know,"
her mother finally said.
"You look like Mama."
"It just worked that way sometimes, baby."
"When are we going home?"
she asked.
"What I tell you,"
her mother said.
"We got to be here a little while. Now stop wiggling around and let me finish."
She was beginning to realize what she would soon know for sure. There was no plan to go back home, or to go anywhere else even, and her mother was lying each time she pretended that there was. The next day, she was sitting alone during lunch when Louisa cornered her, flanked by three beige girls.
"We don't believe you,"
Louisa said.
"About that being your mama. She too pretty to be your mama."
"She's not,"
Jude said.
"My real mama's somewhere else."
"Where at?"
"I don't know. Somewhere. I haven't found her yet."
She was thinking somehow of Stella, a woman who resembled her just as little, but would be a better version of her mother. Stella wouldn't make Daddy so angry that he beat on her. She wouldn't wake Jude in the middle of the night and force her onto a train to a little town where other children taunted her. She would keep her word. Stella wouldn't promise that they would leave Mallard again and again, only to stay.
"You gotta watch your mom," her father had warned her once. "She's still like those folks."
"What folks?"
She was lying on the rug beside him, watching him catch Jax, his large hands blurring in front of her eyes.
"The folks she come from," he said. "Your mama still got some of that in her. She still thinks she better than us."
She didn't understand exactly what he meant, but she liked being part of an us. People thought that being one of a kind made you special. No, it just made you lonely. What was special was belonging with someone else. By high school, the names no longer shocked her, but the loneliness did. You could never quite get used to loneliness. Every time she thought she had, she sank further into it. She sat by herself at lunch, flipping through cheap paperbacks. She never received visits on the weekends, or invitations to Lou's for lunch, or phone calls just to see how she was doing. After school, she went running alone. She was the fastest girl on the track team, and on another team in another town, she might have been captain. But on this team in this town, she stretched alone before practice and sat by herself on the team bus. And after she won the gold medal at the state championship, no one congratulated her but Coach Weaver. Still, she ran. She ran because she loved it, because she wanted to be good at something, because her father had run himself at Ohio State, and when she laced up her cleats, she thought about him. Sometimes when she circled behind the baseball dugout, she felt Lonnie Godot staring. She ran with a hitch in her gait, ungraceful and uneven, a bad habit Coach tried and failed to correct. Lonnie probably thought she ran funny, or maybe he just liked laughing at her. That white top and white shorts against all that black skin. She never felt darker than when she was running, and at the same time, she never felt less black, less anything. She ran in a pair of gold running shoes she'd begged early for one Christmas. Her mother had sighed. "Wouldn't you like a nice dress?" she asked, "or new earrings?" Each year, she shoved the box across the rug as if she could barely stand to touch it. "Gym shoes again," she said glumly, as Jude pulled out the tissue paper. "I swear I'll never understand how one girl could want so many pairs of gym shoes." When she was 11, Early had bought her first pair of running shoes, white New Balance sneakers he'd found in Chicago. The next year, he was off working a job in Kansas, so he didn't come for Christmas at all. Then the next, he was back as if he'd never left, bearing a new pair. And by then, she'd long gotten used to his coming and going, which felt as regular as the seasons.
"That man sniffing around again,"
her grandmother always said. She never called Early by his name, always "that man," or sometimes just "him." She didn't approve of her daughter shacking up with the man, even though Early was never around long enough for his visits to constitute shacking up, which either made it better or worse. Still, each early season, as Jude began to think of it, her mother started to change. First, the house transformed, her mother balancing on chairs, ripping down the curtains, beating dust out of the rugs, washing the windows. Then her clothes, her mother springing for a new pair of nylons, finishing the dress she'd started sewing months ago, shining her shoes until they gleamed. The final and most embarrassing part, her mother preening in the mirror like a vain schoolgirl, flipping her long hair onto one shoulder, then the other, trying a new shampoo that smelled like strawberries. Early loved her hair, so she always paid it special attention. Once, Jude had seen him ease up behind her mother and bury his face in a handful of her hair. She didn't know who she wanted to be in that moment. Early or her mother, beautiful or beholding. And she'd felt so sick with longing that she turned away. Her mother never acknowledged the beginning of an early season, but Mama knew. This, too, was a feature of early season. She and her grandmother, tentative allies, forging clearer allegiance.
All those men,
Mama said.
All those men around town, and she's still out here chasing after him.
In her grandmother's bedroom, Jude maneuvered around the bed, reaching for the bottle of eye drops Dr. Brenner prescribed after her grandmother complained about dryness. Each night before bed, her grandmother rested her head in Jude's lap, her graying hair spread out like a fan, while Jude carefully placed a drop in each eye.
"You should have seen," her grandmother said, "all the boys who loved them."
She still did this sometimes, talked about Jude's mother as them. Jude never corrected her. She slowly released the drop, her grandmother blinking up at her. When Desiree Veens waved at her daughter's bus from the terminal, she waited until the Greyhound disappeared around the corner to wipe the tears from her eyes. She didn't want the last thing for her daughter to see if she had in fact been staring out the back window, to be her silly mother crying as if she'd never see her again. Early handed her a handkerchief, and she laughed, dabbing her eyes.
I'm fine,"
she said, although nobody had asked, and she wasn't. After he dropped her by Lou's egg house for her shift, she realized, tying her apron, that she was starting her day the same way she'd started it for the past 10 years, except that this time, she did not know when she would see her daughter again. 10 years. She had been home 10 years. Sometimes, she glanced around the house, shaking her head, as if she still didn't understand how she'd found herself back. As if she were in the Wizard of Oz, but instead of a house dropping on her, she'd fallen through the roof and awakened years later, dazed to realize that she was still there. When she'd first decided to stay, she gave herself practical reasons. She didn't earn enough at Lou's to live anywhere else. She couldn't abandon her mother again. She still hoped that Stella might return home on her own. And even if Stella didn't, Desiree felt closer to her here, wandering around Stella's old things. The chair where Stella sat at the table, a corn husk doll Stella named Jane. Everywhere around the house, a door handle or blanket or couch cushion that Stella had once touched, bearing the invisible remnants of her fingerprints. She'd made a sort of life for herself here, hadn't she? With her mother and her daughter and Early Jones, who left and continued to leave, but also continued to return. When he visited, Desiree felt like a girl again, the years falling away like meat off the bone. His arrivals always seemed a little miraculous. Once she was carrying a country fried steak and eggs to a table and found Early sitting at the end of the counter, chewing on a toothpick. Another time she locked up the diner and turned to see Early leaning against the phone booth across the road. She was exhausted, but still laughed at the sight of him, as unexpected as the sudden coming of spring. One day there was frost, and the next, bloom.
"I was just thinking about you,"
he'd say, as if he had stopped by on his way home, not driven all the way from Charleston, pressing on through the night, bleary-eyed, to get to her sooner.
"Wondering what you was up to."
She was never up to anything, of course, her days blending together into a sameness that she later found comforting. No surprises, no sudden anger, no man holding her one moment, then hitting her the next. Now life was steady. She knew what each day would bring, except when Early appeared. He was the only thing in her life she wasn't prepared for. He never stayed longer than a day or two before he was gone again. Once he'd convinced her to call in sick to lose so that he could take her fishing. They didn't catch anything, but halfway through the afternoon he kissed her, slipping his fingers under her dress, stroking her as they floated on the glassy lake. It was the most thrilling thing that had happened to her in months. When Early came to town, her mother grew grim and tight-lipped, glaring at the door when Desiree slipped out to meet him at the boarding house.
"I don't know why you fooling around with that man," she said. "Can't stick around, find no decent work."
"He works," Desiree said.
"Nothing decent," her mother said.
"Probably got all type of women out there running after him."
"Well, that's his business, not mine."
She didn't ask who Early spent his nights with outside of Mallard. He didn't ask her either. Each time he left, she missed him. But she wondered if his leaving was the only reason why they worked. He wasn't a settling man. And maybe she wasn't a settling woman either. When she thought about marriage, she felt trapped with Sam in an airless apartment, bracing herself through each calm moment for his inevitable rage. But Early was easy. He had no hidden sides. They didn't argue, and if she ever grew annoyed with him, she was comforted by the fact that soon enough, he would be gone again. He couldn't trap her, because he refused to trap himself. She'd had to convince him to stay at the house when he visited.
"Oh, I don't know, Desiree,"
he'd said, rubbing his jaw slowly.
"I'm not asking for a ring," she said. "I'm not really asking for anything. It just don't make sense, me running out to the boarding house all the time. And I think with Jude, it would be better if..."
But she paused here. She never wanted Early to think that she expected him to be a father to her daughter. He didn't owe the two of them anything. Owing was never part of their arrangement.
"What about your mama?" he said.
"Don't worry about her. I'll take care of all that. I just think, well, it don't make sense. That's all. We two grown people. I'm tired of sneaking around."
"Well, all right," he said.
The next time he came to town, he met her at her mother's house. He stood on the porch, carefully unlacing his dirty boots, and moved inside the house as if it were a fancy store and he was afraid he'd break something. He'd brought, ridiculously, flowers for the table, and she filled a vase with water, feeling like they were playing a married couple. Early carrying on like a television husband, "Honey, I'm homing" her from the doorway. He'd also brought gifts from his travels, a new purse for her, a bottle of perfume her mother refused to thank him for, and a book for Jude. She had explained to her daughter that Early would come to stay with them.
"All the time?" Jude asked.
"No, not all the time," Desiree said. "Just sometimes, when he's in town."
Her daughter paused, then said,
"Well, maybe he shouldn't come here. Maybe we should go with him."
"We can't, baby. He don't even have a real house. That's why we gotta stay here. But he'll come visit and bring you nice things. Wouldn't you like that?"
She knew better, of course. Her daughter only wanted to leave. She'd wanted to leave Mallard since they'd arrived, and Desiree, ashamed, kept promising that they would. She couldn't promise Jude that the other children would be kind, or eat lunch with her, or invite her over to play. So when another birthday party arrived, without Jude receiving an invitation, Desiree told her daughter that none of this would matter once they'd left town. Leaving was the only thing she could offer. But, she thought, watching Early and Jude read together on the carpet, maybe staying wasn't the worst thing for Jude. She had family here, at least. She was loved. At night, Desiree held her daughter and told her stories about her own childhood, At first, she said, I have a sister named Stella. Then, you have an aunt. Then, once upon a time, a girl named Stella lived here. For years, Early tracked Stella Veens until she was no longer Stella Veens. She'd been Stella Veens in New Orleans and Boston. Then the trail ran cold. She'd married, he figured, but he couldn't find a marriage license for a Stella Veens in any place he knew she'd been. So she'd married someplace else. She was still, he assumed, Stella. A new first name was too difficult to get used to. Only a professional con man could assume a completely new identity, and Stella was nobody's professional. Why worry about carefulness if you didn't expect anyone to come looking for you? She'd been sloppy enough that he found her apartment in Boston.
Oh, she was real nice, the landlady said when he called. Quiet, worked somewhere downtown, a department store maybe, then upped and left. But she was real nice, never caused no trouble.
He imagined Stella behind a perfume counter, spraying pink bulbs toward ladies passing by, or gift-wrapping dolls during Christmas. He'd had one or two dreams where he was chasing her through a Sears and Roebuck, Stella ducking behind dress carousels and shoe racks.
She have a boyfriend?
He asked. The landlady grew silent after that, then said she had to go. A colored man asking after a white woman. She'd already said too much. But not enough for Early, who hadn't even found a forwarding address. Stella sprinkled breadcrumbs, which was almost worse than nothing. Almost, because he didn't want to find Stella at all. There'd been a time in the beginning, at least he told himself this, when he'd wanted to find her in earnest. Now, looking back, he wasn't so sure. Maybe it had always been Desiree's will, tugging him along. He'd wanted to please her. That was why he'd offered to hunt for Stella in the first place. He wanted to find Stella because Desiree wished her found. Those wishes overlapped into a single desire, one that kept him on the trail for years. But Stella did not want to be found, and that desire seemed even stronger. Desiree pulled, then Stella pulled harder. Early, somehow, had been caught between. Now time had fallen right out of his pockets when he wasn't looking. One morning, he climbed out of Desiree Veens' bed and found a gray hair in his beard. He spent 10 minutes in front of the bathroom mirror, rooting around for others, startled, for the first time, by his own face. He was, he suspected, beginning to look more and more like his own father, which was as unsettling as transforming into a stranger. Then he felt arms around his waist, Desiree pressing against his back. You about done staring at yourself? She asked.
I found a gray hair, he said. Look, right here.
She laughed suddenly. After all those years, he still felt delighted by that laugh, stunned to be caught in its blast.
Well, I hope you didn't think you'd be young and cute forever, she said, ushering him to the side so that she could brush her teeth.
He leaned against the doorway, watching her. Most mornings, she opened Lou's at 4, so she was gone by the time he woke up. Then again, most mornings, he woke up someplace other than this bed. He would lie in the backseat of his car or sprawl across the stained mattress in some rundown motel, imagining Desiree's room, the dark wooden walls, the dresser lined with photographs, the calico blue bedspread, her childhood room, the bed she'd once shared with Stella. Early had learned to sleep on Stella's side, and sometimes when they made love, he felt shy, like Stella was perched on the dresser, watching. Desiree splashed water on her face. He wanted to pull her back into bed. There was never enough of her. He could never love her the way he wanted to. Full. A full love would scare her. Each time he returned to Mallard, he thought about bringing a ring. Her mother, at least, would finally respect him. She might even begin to think of him like a son. But Desiree never wanted to marry again.
"I've been through all that already," she said, with the same weariness of a soldier talking about war.
It had been a war, in a sense, one that she could never win and only hope to survive. She told him about all the ways Sam had hurt her, slamming her face into the door, dragging her by her hair across the bathroom floor, backhanding her mouth, his hands streaked with lipstick and blood. She touched Early's mouth gently, and he kissed her fingertips, trying to reconcile that quiet voice he'd heard over the phone 10 years ago with the man she described. She didn't know where Sam lived now, but Early, of course, had traced him already. He lived in Norfolk with his new wife and 3 boys, exactly what the world didn't need, 3 boys growing up to be spiteful men. But he'd never told Desiree this. What good would it do?
"Jude called last night," Desiree said.
"Yeah,"
he said.
"How's she getting on?"
"You know her. She never tell me much. But I think she good. She likes it out there. She said to tell you hi."
He grunted, doubtful thousands of miles away that she was even thinking about him at all. He only reminded her of the father who wasn't there. Desiree patted his stomach.
"You take a look at that leaking sink, baby."
At least she asked nice. Not like Adele, who barely looked at him across the table, called out, "Chair's wobbly," when she passed him on her way to work, treated him like a glorified handyman. And maybe he was. He was the man of a house he barely lived in. He was the father to a daughter who didn't even like him. In the kitchen, he squeezed under the sink, his back aching. Everything was catching up with him now. Nights spent sleeping in his car, hours hiding in some crawl space. He wasn't young anymore. Not the same young man who'd felt a jolt of energy each time he set out on a new job. Now it was only tiredness, boredom even. He'd hunted every type of man there was. He'd still never found the people he'd searched for the longest. On the best nights, he settled in Desiree Veens's bed, rubbing her feet. He watched her brush out her hair, listened to her hum. He shucked off his pants, and she climbed in bed in her nightgown. And even then it felt like too many layers. A lie, really, that they were telling themselves, because as soon as she turned out the light, his boxer shorts were around his ankles, her nightgown pushed up to her waist. They tried to be quiet, but after a while he didn't care about anyone hearing. Not when there were too few nights like this. On the road, he tried to remember how to fall asleep alone.
"Gets harder, you know,"
he told Desiree one night.
"More time goes by. Sometimes folks slip up, but
I know," she said. Her skin looked silvery in the moonlight. He rolled toward her, touching her hip. She was so slender he forgot sometimes the longer he was away.
"She might come back on her own," he said. "Homesick. Maybe she gets older. Figures none of this is worth it."
He reached over, touching Desiree's soft curls. He was so hungry and so full of her, he could hardly stand it. But she rolled away from him.
"It's too late," she said. "Even if she comes back, she's already gone."
In Los Angeles, no one had ever heard of Mallard. All freshman year, Jude delighted in telling people that her hometown was impossible to find on a map, even though few believed her at first, especially not Reese Carter, who insisted that every town had to be on a map somewhere. He was more skeptical than the Californians, who easily believed that some Louisiana town might be too inconsequential to warrant a cartographer's attention. But Reese was a Southerner also. He grew up in El Dorado, Arkansas, a place that sounded even more fantastical than her hometown, yet still existed on maps. So one April evening, she dragged him to the library and flipped through a giant atlas. They'd just stepped in from the rain, Reese's wet hair looping across his forehead in loose curls. She wanted to push his drooping hair back, but instead she pointed at a map of Louisiana, below where the Atchafalaya River and the Red River met. "See," she said, "no mallet."
"God damn," he said, "you're right."
He leaned over her shoulder, squinting. They'd met at a track and field party her roommate, Erica, had dragged her to last Halloween. Erica was a stout sprinter from Brooklyn who complained about Los Angeles endlessly. The smoggy air, the traffic, the lack of trains. Her grievances only made Jude realize how grateful she felt. Gratitude only emphasized the depth of your lack, so she tried to hide it. On move-in day, Erica had glanced at Jude's two suitcases and asked, "Where's the rest of your stuff?" Her own desk was cluttered with records, photographs of friends taped to the walls, her closet stuffed with shimmery blouses. Jude, quietly unpacking everything she owned, said that her other things were still in storage. She knew that she liked Erica when she never brought it up again. On Halloween, Erica draped herself in a sparkly purple dress and tiara, Jude reaching for a lazy pair of cat ears. In the bathroom, she sat on the toilet lid while Erica hunched in front of her, powdering electric blue on her eyelids. "You know, you could look real pretty if you tried a little," she said. But the bright blue only made her look darker. So Jude dabbed at her eyes during the whole ride over. Later, Reese would tell her that the blue eyeshadow was the first thing he noticed about her. In the cramped apartment, she'd stumbled after Erica, squeezing past witches and ghosts and mummies. When Erica fished in the ice-filled bathtub for beers, Jude ducked into a doorway, overwhelmed by it all. She'd never been invited to a stranger's party before, and she was so nervous she didn't even notice, at first, a cowboy sitting on the couch. He was golden brown and handsome, his jaw covered in stubble. He wore a rawhide vest over a blue plaid shirt and faded jeans, a red bandana tied around his neck. She felt him watching her, and not knowing what else to do, said, "Hi, I'm Jude." She tugged at the fringe of her skirt, already embarrassed, but the cowboy smiled.
"Hi, Jude," he said. "I'm Reese. Have a beer."
She liked how he said it, more of a command than an offer, but she shook her head.
"I don't drink beer," she said. "I mean, I don't like the taste, and it makes me feel slow. I'm a runner."
She was rambling now, but he tilted his head a little.
"Where you from?"
he said.
"Louisiana." "Whereabouts?"
"A little town. You haven't heard of it."
"Oh, you know what I've heard of."
"Trust me," she said, "I know."
He laughed, then tilted his beer toward her.
"You sure you don't want to sip?"
Maybe it was his accent, southern like hers. Maybe his handsomeness. Maybe because in a room full of people, he'd chosen to talk to her. She took a step toward him, then another, and another, until she was standing inside his legs. Then a loud group of boys jostled into the room with a keg, and Reese reached out, pulling her into safety. His hand cupped the back of her knee, and for weeks after, when she thought about that party, she only remembered his fingers lingering at the edge of her skirt. Now, in the damp library, she flipped through the atlas, past Louisiana, to the United States, to the world.
"When I was little,"